This is the Climb to Space.
Hello and welcome to the Decline to State Internet Radio Stream, the show in which we get together to discuss the ups and downs of life outside the Matrix. Decline to State is proud to bring you in a surprisingly few netcasts in which the hosts do not support acts of aggression against you. You can find us on the web at declinefm.com. You will find a link to the live chat. The live chat is your go-to way to interact with other listeners or bring up points for discussion on the show. This is important because we have a guest on who not only endorses the non-aggression principle, but further, he abides by the zero aggression principle. You can find our archived episodes not only on declinefm.com, but also under Decline to State on iTunes. I'm Ronald McPaul, your beacon of freedom in the heart of the Silicon Valley, and I'm joined by my handsome co-casters, and I'll let them go around the horn and introduce themselves.
This is Kwashi Orkor.
Wrong opinion here, coming to you from the Rust Belt.
And as I hinted, I'm pleased that we have a guest on. I'm pleased to announce we are joined by the Bad Quaker, Ben Stone, whose podcast can be found on badquaker.com. And I thought for an introduction, I would relate to the listeners what I learned about good Quakers on the badquaker.com about page. And then we can let Ben tell us what a bad Quaker is. So good Quakers, or just general Quakers maybe, Quakers can vary in their beliefs and practices, but are perhaps best known for their unshakable position on individuality. Quakers have refused to use or acknowledge titles of honor. Quakers do not swear oaths of any kind. Likewise, standing, sitting, bowing, kneeling, saluting, or adjusting one's attire upon command or for the purpose of bestowing honor are not practiced by Quakers. So that's just kind of picking and choosing, but I learned a lot from the About page today. So, okay, Ben, so thanks for joining us, and especially after your bedtime, but why don't you go ahead and tell us what a bad Quaker is?
Sure. Yeah, many of those things you just said were very appealing to me as I was kind of investigating Quakerism. The official terminology is the Religious Society of Friends, but that's really a stick in the mud type of a name. So I was investigating them for different purposes altogether, and I realized, man, I like some of this stuff. Like, I don't like tipping my hat to somebody just because I'm supposed to. You know, if I make some kind of adjustment to my attire or whatever by choice, that's one thing. But having to bow or salute or call somebody, you know, you're honorable, whatever, it just never felt right to me. And the more I looked into it, the more I thought, well, you know, this is really what I've always been. But there was just the one thing that really stood in my way of being a Quaker, and that was the vast majority of them are pacifists, and that's very fundamental to Quakers as being a pacifist. And I appreciate people who are pacifists, and I don't want to offend them or anything like that, but I find it at least for me, it's a very unnatural position to be in. I've never really been one to allow someone else to do the defense for me, or just trust that the universe will take care of me, or you know, whatever. I don't know. It just seems completely unnatural to not defend yourself, your property, the people you care about, and defend the defenseless. So I could never be a good Quaker in that sense. And so my friends and people around me we stumbled onto this phrase, bad Quaker, because clearly I could never be a good Quaker. So what does that make me?
It's a great name, by the way.
And then when you take a look at the pictures of me that are on the website, I've got a little over three quarters of a million miles on motorcycles, and I've hung out with some pretty rough people in my day. So my looks and this brand name Bad Quaker, it really fits well.
Yeah, that's great. I learned a lot, and I think I kind of fell into the notion of Quakerism that you mentioned, I think, offhand for a second, right? That it's a religious group. But when I was, I learned a lot on your about page, and when I was reading through it, I was like, yes, okay. Where do I sign up for this?
Now, do you associate with other Quakers, good or bad, or is it just a pretty much an independent thing for you?
I'll answer both the actual part of that question and the part that's inferred. Most Quakers actually do meet together. They call them meetings, oddly enough, and they meet pretty regularly. I say regularly, some of them meet every week, some of them meet once a year, some of them meet once every 6 months. But I've never really had any inclination to do that. So that's another aspect that I'm not a very good Quaker, because I don't attend any of the meetings at all. And I don't have anything against the, what you might call good Quakers. But in the same sense, I also, unless they're really into, liberty, the zero aggression principle, property rights, and unless they're really into that kind of stuff, I really don't have that much in common with them.
But it does seem like there is at least a sufficiently individualist approach to things. That's part of the good Quaker part too, right?
Yeah, absolutely. That's one of the strong things that drew me towards them, was that no one Quaker can say to another Quaker, in reference to theology, religion, faith, that kind of thing. No one Quaker can look at another and say, you're wrong and I'm right. Because these are things that you can't really prove. These are things in the in the spiritual realm that are, in a sense, very much based on theory or what you believe. So even if a person is a complete atheist and they don't believe in anything in the spiritual realm whatsoever, then I don't have the right to tell them they're wrong, because how would I know? I don't have any, I can't walk them over and show them, here's God, hold his hand, touch him, talk to him. That's an impossibility. So how can I possibly insist on something being a fact if I can't absolutely prove it?
I have to say, I find that aspect of the Quaker philosophy very appealing myself. I was raised as a Jehovah's Witness, and in that culture, there is no such thing as what you just described. If you believe anything remotely contrary to the official doctrine, and you don't come into lockstep quickly, your status in the congregation will quickly plummet, and all kinds of rumors will abound about you. And you can even be excommunicated simply for a disagreement on matters of doctrine or theory, or even personal disagreements with persons of influence in the congregation.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's kind of the exact opposite, really.
Yeah.
Feels bad, man.
Yeah. Yeah. It was pretty tough.
Now, did you part ways with that, Ron? Or are you
Well, let's see. Without going too much into myself, because we're talking to Ben here tonight, but I'd say I had my first serious doubts when I was in my middle teen years, and the straw that broke the camel's back, I'd say, was my 18th year of life, when I was kicked out of my house, kind of informally shunned by the congregation, and my grandfather died all in the same year. So that really did it for me. But yeah, pretty hard. Well, pretty hard stuff.
Yeah. Now, sorry to turn.
Now, Ron, you could become a Quaker, and I understand that that Ben is in Ohio too. Is that correct?
Yeah. Yeah.
So you guys could meet up. You could go to the gun range on Sundays, and attract other followers too. It'd be great.
Actually, I look pretty funny at the gun range. I go out there whenever I can, and I have the traditional. It's kind of fun to do this, but I have a traditional Amish hat, and with my beard, and I have suspenders and a white shirt with roll up sleeves and all this kind of thing. I go walking out there to the gun range, and I get some really strange looks when I lay out about 6 or 8 pistols and 4 or 5 rifles.
That is so great.
It's pretty classy, if you ask me.
That's great.
As I think as Ron was letting you know that he's kind of been introducing us to you, which has been great, and you know, I want to compliment your radio voice too. But one cast I did check out, I think, was a last week one, November 7th, and there was a lot of great content there. I mean, you're just going off the cuff, and you went on some, I'm not going to say rant, but some kind of mini discussion about some pretty heavy topic, and then you said, okay, that's not really the topic for the show, so let's go on to the thing. And I was like, that was good material for a little, like, sidebar.
Yeah, I go on rants like that occasionally. It's kind of hard to keep things reined in.
Oh, yeah. Don't I know that. Well, what is... I guess what's new to us is, because we're kind of always pushing and pulling against each other, doing a solo podcast, how does that differ? I mean, do you find days where you just totally get lost or go on tangents, or how do you stay on track?
I have a like a notes outline, and I try to have points that I want to take from one point to the next point. And most of the time, I would say probably 60 or 70% of the time, I stick pretty good with that, because I try to time my podcast to exactly an hour. So I kind of have a try to keep a rough idea of how much progress I've made through my notes, and try to time myself like that. But at other times, every podcast I've done this week so far, I have started to do my notes and thought of a completely separate thought, and just pushed the notes to the side and just started talking and just watched the clock. And so I've still got my notes from Monday. I haven't used my notes from Monday yet. So, you know, it goes both ways. Sometimes I just take off rambling on one particular thought and will just try to, you know, think it through, as much as possible to every aspect of it, or every nuance of it, to try to, you know, find out where that thought comes from. What is it? What supports it? Where did I learn it from? Is it real, or is it just something I was told? And I break these things as much as possible.
Well, what made you want to start getting into podcasting? What was it that attracted you? Did you aspire to be a broadcaster? Did you emulate certain radio personalities? What was it that really got you?
Bill O'Reilly, perhaps?
For years, I had, like I think maybe a lot of people do, for years I had 5 different identities on the internet that I bounced around to forums and different places like that, and I would write and express my thoughts in writing, and I kind of settled down to just a couple forums, and was really putting a lot of effort into them, you know, 4 or 5 hours a day, and I thought, man, I'm putting a lot of myself into somebody else's website. And, you know, I expressed that thought to a few people around me, and my wife and some friends said, well, you know, why don't we just set up a website just for as an avenue just for you to say whatever you want to say. And so originally it was all just me. The idea was I was going to post articles there, and just like a regular blog. And it developed from that into an occasional, well, you know, why don't you read? Because some people aren't going to want to sit there and read an hour's worth of material or 45 minutes worth of material. Why don't you do an audio version of them? Kind of like what Jeff Riggenbach, is that his name?
Yeah.
Was doing, yeah, over at Mises. And so I thought, well, yeah, I could probably do that. I've got a fairly deep voice. And so I started reading the articles, and then my daughter kind of joined in, and we started doing just a chat between the two of us. We say pretty often we're the only father-daughter anarchist podcasting team on the on the internet. And it worked out pretty good. We started getting an audience, but she wasn't really available to do podcasts all that often. So I was, and here was the other thing. For me to write an article, if I write a decent article of, say, 2,000 words or so, I'm going to invest close to 18 hours of work on it, because I'm such a perfectionist on writing stuff like that. But if I sit down and I stumble, and, you know, in speech, and I stutter and I just wander around, around, and I have enough of a sort of a vague Midwestern Appalachian out west accent, enough to where nobody really, it's not going to be obvious where my accent is coming from. So it's kind of like an everyman's accent, unless you're an extreme on one of the coasts, you know. Then there's a certain homeness to my voice.
Yeah.
And so I get away with rambling on and saying things that maybe somebody with better speech can't get away with, you know, and for some reason people still listen.
Well, you're very fortunate to have the support of your wife. I mean, mine just says, isn't there something else you could be doing right now?
Take out the trash, Quash.
I kind of like that you mentioned your combination of accents, because you've traveled a lot in your time, and you've also spoken a lot in the past on your podcasts about how would I put it? I guess just Appalachian folk and the history behind them. You seem to know a lot about that, and I always find it fascinating when you talk about that. How did you learn about all that? Was it just a combination of being around those people and also reading about them, or you know, how did that all come to be?
I have read quite a bit about Appalachia and the people and the culture and so forth, and a lot of it comes through, you know, my family in Appalachia would very often just sit around and tell stories and talk for hours at a time. And then in addition to that, there was an old man that I knew when I was, I guess from about the time I was about 10 until I was about 15, I was exposed to this old guy at least once a week or so. And he was what you would probably consider one of the best experts on Appalachia at the time. This was in the early and mid 70s, and I'm stalling because I'm trying to remember his name, but I can't remember it. But he he's gone now, but he was a distant relative and a fairly well-known figure. He would speak at several different universities at times on Appalachian culture. And so I would just be fascinated sitting, listening to him talk and tell about, you know, clothing styles and how they gathered rainwater to get them through the summers, even though they all had wells. And he would go into all these details and the history of how Appalachian culture was never really part of the colonies and so forth. My family moved into Appalachia, the best we can tell, probably about the 1670s, 1680s. And then later, the Stone, you know, my last name being Stone, the Stone parts of my family were newcomers to Appalachia. They didn't arrive until almost 1800. And then they arrived under very questionable circumstances. They had a land grant given to them by the state of Virginia. And so they came in basically as, you know, outsiders and took land that other people believed that they owned. So, you know, you get to find out about these things. And my family was in a feud for that lasted about two generations. So you hear these stories and you realize it's nothing like you're seeing on TV. It's nothing like the movies. It's nothing like most books, but it's right there. And they're, you know, they talk about these things. Well, I don't know about now because most of those old people have gone, but when I was a kid, they were talking about stuff from the 1700s, 1800s, like almost like if they were eyewitnesses to it, because the stories had been told so many times.
That I think all that history and that culture, I think, gives you quite a powerful position to speak from when it comes to the beginning of what some people might call American history. Even though it kind of really is invaders, European invader history, but you can speak from some unique positions on the effects that the state had on people who were by and large stateless, and you do bring that up from time to time, and I think that's always a fascinating thing to talk about and think about and learn about, because time people will bring up as an objection to a stateless society, things like, well, this has never existed before, or, you know, it would just devolve into anarchy. And what they mean by that is chaos. Of course, it's anarchy, but they really mean, you know, chaos and bloodshed. But as you've pointed out many times, the standard for the vast majority of humanity's existence on the face of the earth has been anarchy and has been, by and large, peaceful until very recently.
Yeah, and Appalachia is a really good example of that. The state, or, you know, more specifically, governments of different kinds, didn't really start to move into Appalachia with any kind of strength until well up into the 1800s. In the, like, around 1812, there was 1810, maybe it was 1810, I guess it was 1810, there was a census. And the census workers in Appalachia were not welcomed. and it got pretty bloody, you know, because they saw that as this government moving in on them. They didn't see that as some kind of service to them or anything like that. And that even to a certain extent still exists in Appalachia. But all the time, say, through the Revolutionary War, as it's called, I like to call it the War of Independence, but through that whole time frame, Appalachia never really saw themselves, the people, that is, of Appalachia. The mountains didn't have any feelings, as far as I know, but the people of Appalachia didn't really see themselves as colonists. They didn't see themselves as subjects of Britain, because they had been, in a very real sense, they had been cast out of first out of Scotland, then oftentimes out of either Ireland or out of the borderlands between Scotland and England. And they were considered, even the phrase hillbilly, they had that phrase long before they came to Appalachia, because of they came from the mountains and the hills of southern Scotland, after they had lost their property because of their religious persecution that they endured. And so they were from the hills, and they supported William of Orange in the wars that were going on. So they were referred to as hillbillies. And of course, they actually fought as mercenaries in that war, and many of them never got paid. They just got basically deported instead. So it's a long history. Appalachia has a long history. Specifically, the Scotch-Irish people of Appalachia have had a long history of being abused by the government, but of having this clan system that works entirely without government interference. And in one form or another, tribal or clan systems have functioned throughout the world, and even do still today. You know, they still have law, they still have order, they still have property dispute resolutions, and they have all the things that we think of that you need government to do for you. They have them, but they have them without government.
So this has persisted to today. Do you see a current of, you know, anti-government or independence from the federal government in Appalachia today?
Most of it's been killed through one kind of welfare program or the other. Most of the independent spirit in Appalachia is dead. There is some leftover in things like bootlegging and, you know, marijuana production. These traditions still keep a little bit of that independent thought alive, and you know, that hate for the government is still there. But it's been neutered so bad, because so many of the people in Appalachia are completely dependent on the government for their income. So, you know, it's very sad.
And so do you think there's many who've signed up to petition against for secession recently?
There's a lot of talk about that. I'm a little skeptical if that's has any value or not, because, you know, going to whitehouse.gov and asking that they please pay attention, it doesn't quite taste right to me.
Yeah, I posted some disparaging remarks on a thread the other day on Reddit, and was severely downvoted for it by the patriotic libertarians over there. So
I imagine.
They kind of don't want you to point out, at least from what I've observed, that they're trading a state that's far away and largely unconcerned with them to a state that's much closer and much more concerned with them. And that seems like a poor strategical move, in my opinion.
Well, while I tend to agree, we might not want to be too mean to them, because, you know, Right Coast did help us last week bring some of those guys over as the moderator.
Very true, very true.
Just a minor gripe, wrong. One thing I was going to say too, because I'm on Wikipedia like that. If it helps the audience who's not in Ohio or on the Appalachia, of course it refers to the Appalachian Mountain Range. But you guys are talking about the cultural region, so I guess if this is right, the eastern the cultural region in the eastern United States, it stretches from the southern tier of New York State to northern Alabama, Mississippi, and Georgia. And I guess it's approximately, as of 2005, so not current, super up to date, but about 23 million people in the area.
Yeah, and oftentimes there's another little group of Scotch-Irish, descended from Scotch, from the same Scotch-Irish rebels that are way up around Maine and a little bit in New Hampshire and Vermont that, they've been exposed a lot more to government, and they've been separated geographically from the ones in down in the rest of southern Appalachia. But in many ways, there's a lot of commonness there.
You don't know anything about those blue people, do you?
The blue people in North Africa?
There's a genetically distinct group of people who have some kind of mutation which cause blue skin.
This
is a real thing.
I remember reading about that.
So, they were Appalachian, and apparently there was some closed community, we'll say, so that the genetic error was it continued on for some period of time, and now I'm going to have to look up what it is so that people
We have LDL who's a biology wizard in the producer chat, and he's already got the link up. Maybe we can put it in the show notes. But inbreeding turns Appalachians blue. Quash, I'm sorry, I was totally unawares.
This kind of reminds me of a
crazy stories. Yeah.
Oh, sorry, I didn't mean to run over you.
Go ahead.
This kind of reminds me of just. Even more tangential, of a fella who I think might have been either a senator or a congressman at one time out west. I forget what state. But he was very enthusiastic about colloidal silver and other silver-related products for staying healthy. And he actually over-ingested silver to the point where his blood became blue from the silver content. And apparently it's not a condition that's toxic to the human body. But because it's a heavy metal and the human body didn't evolve or wasn't built to filter that out, it just kind of sticks around. And so this guy, I think it was called Argyria or something like that, after, the Latin root for silver. And it just kind of, that reminded me of that other thing that's even more tangential, but it is related to silver, which we all like, I guess. No, so I guess it's not entirely off track.
It's also practical, too. I mean, who says ANCAPs don't provide real-life information? We've actually provided people with information about two ways to turn yourself blue, or at least your lineage.
Ooh, that just gave me a crazy idea. Ben might be the only other person around here right now that will be familiar with this joke, but I wonder how much that guy's blood would be worth.
Well, if the zombie apocalypse is bad enough, we might have to just melt him down and find out.
We'll go disinter him, because he was an older guy, so I'm sure he won't be around anymore by then.
I think the bad Quakers are going to do better than the good Quakers in the zombie apocalypse.
What do you think?
Yeah, then? Yeah, I think so. Okay, weaponry and the knowledge of how to use them can be really handy in a lot of circumstances.
I mentioned earlier on, and sorry if you already spoke to it, Ben, but the zero aggression principle has a good sound to it. It's like taking NAP up a notch. How do you view that, or what is that? I mean, I think it kind of explains itself, but
Well, I've heard it, I've heard it called both non-aggression and zero aggression principle. Zero aggression always appealed to me because it sounded more definite and more finite, whereas non kind of sounded a little smoother and softer. And then when we started setting up the Bad Quaker website, I found out that a lot of people use the non-aggression principle in their tags for Google, but almost nobody uses a zero aggression principle. So I thought, aha, I can basically grab a phrase that's relatively common that I actually like more than the other phrase anyway, and just tag it like crazy. And Google wise, Google wise, I will sort of, own this phrase to a certain extent as much as an ANCAP can own any phrase.
It seems like you kind of have a knack for branding and putting ideas out there. And, I recall from earlier in the cast, you were mentioning that it sounds like the website and, later the podcast, it kind of progressed naturally, right? You realized, perhaps like some of us on Decline to State, that we were spending kind of a lot of time on the internet posting things and inventing ideas, and all of a sudden it's like, let's get together some way somehow and take it to the next level. And more to that too, on the website it says it's managed by friends, family, and supporters of Ben Stone. So is that in large part, you mentioned your daughter, or is there a broader network there too?
Yeah, we had I have two daughters, and they're both involved, and my wife. My wife is the primary owner and decision maker on the website itself, and then we have my son-in-law passed away earlier this year, but he had a lot of influence on it as well. As a matter of fact, he was sort of our resident atheist, so he was available to give me a lot of his input, his thoughts and ideas and so forth that I, in angles that I wouldn't necessarily look at them myself.
Yeah, sorry to hear that.
Thank you. But then also there's some outside people as well. Our first donor that dropped in enough money to get the whole thing rolling preferred to, not be named and to stay completely anonymous. And so...
Mitt Romney?
Oh, no. Not quite.
You've been found out, Ben.
Yeah. Oh, no. I'm a spy.
We're a sleuthy podcast. We get all the secrets out. This is where it happens.
I bet he sends love letters to George Soros too.
Yeah.
So was this donor anonymous? Was this donor anonymous to you as well, or just asked you to kind of keep his or her name on the DL?
Yeah, they were involved in another prominent website, and they just asked that we not use their, not refer to them in order to not bring any conflict with the other website that they weren't necessarily giving that kind of money to.
Because people seem to have this thing about anarchy, we've noticed. A lot of what we talk about on the cast, I think, and maybe what people, when they listen, relate to is we're just able to discuss this stuff glibly because we're friends among the internet, whether it's can be hard to run into other like-minded people to such a quote-unquote extreme in real life, it seems. So just the vernacular and the tools and tricks of interaction with people seems to be helpful. But again, maybe that might be another reason why we enjoy using our Reddit handles too, because it's when you work for I have a status job, I call it, and I don't necessarily want to them to know about anarcho-capitalism as a perspective.
I can definitely relate that. I worked in the aerospace industry, defense industry for years and years, and although I was vocal about my opinions then, and I should say my opinions weren't quite as refined then as they are now, but even then I had pretty radical opinions, and I was foolish enough to just say them. Maybe I didn't go around broadcasting them, but if someone asked me my opinion, I would tell them, and it was uncomfortable at times.
Yeah, I'm in the medical field, so another those two might be some of the most heavily regulated ones there are, fairly conservative, and I know what you mean. I just the other day I had a colleague, you know, I messaged. I think she's out in. She's actually out in Ohio too. It was kind of funny, but she said, you know, what's your perspective? I kind of liked Romney, but I don't like the government. I was like, oh, you're baiting me into sharing more than I probably should with a coworker. And I, you know, there was a couple inoffensive links. You know, there's things like George ought to help, which get spread out. And I'm, after even sending it as a link, I'm just still kind of, should I regret this?
Yeah, I had those moments exactly like that as well, where someone would be talking to me about, you know, what do you think, you know, the economy's doing this or that. What do you think is a good investment or a safe, you know, way to handle your portfolio? And my advice is get it out of everything to do with the stock market. Buy solid, real money like silver and gold, and don't have it in some faraway bank that you just own a piece of paper that tells you you have it. If you don't have a good safe, buy a good safe, bolt it to the floor, hide it underneath the floor, and all of a sudden, I'm the crazy one in the room.
Well, how do you deal with it now? You know, I mean, you've got some, now that you have you're a web personality now, you know, you run into people in the street, friends, relatives, or whatever, you know, they must be curious about what you do. You know, are you free to share them your podcasts? You know, do you freely, you know, tell them how is this happening and how is it working out in your personal life?
I don't make a big deal, you know, to the neighbors and family that don't really understand what I'm doing. I don't really push it hard or anything like that. I wear a Bad Quaker t-shirt with the web address on the back and that kind of
thing. And you have six pistols with you.
Yeah, at least. Only on Tuesdays when I'm having the other three cleaned. oftentimes, though, just the idea that it has something to do with Quaker will prevent people from asking me very many questions, because they immediately they think it's some off-brand of Amish or that I'm a religious nut or something, and they prefer not to ask me about it. So that so I get out of a lot of conversations that way when I want to be left alone. So I get to pick and choose when I can bring this stuff up.
That's pretty good. It's pretty good.
You could say you're a Jehovah's anarchist.
You know what's funny about that is part of the Jehovah's Witness doctrine is that all governments, and by extension the state, are actually entities of Satan, and they're only allowed to exist because God is permitting them to exist for the moment. So I guess you could say Jehovah's Witnesses are technically anarchist insofar as they think that God should be the only version of the state and no man should be the state.
You should start your own prophecy that there's going to be 144,000 anarchists who go into the millennium.
I'd really rather not. That's a funny idea, though. I meant to segue with Ben into a question that I think about a lot of the time, and I think it keeps me from losing my sanity. I wanted to see if he thought similarly on this point. And would you agree, Ben, that most people already embrace voluntarism without really realizing it? Like maybe they're kind of like in a state of nature?
Yeah, I do believe that. And to demonstrate it, I often talk about family reunions. And my family has, you know, is a fairly large family, lots of uncles and lots of cousins and so forth. And once a year in Appalachia, we have a big family reunion. And it's way out away from any town. It's not anywhere near any kind of large city or any even very large town. I think the closest town might have, you know, 1,200 residents or something like that. So there's, you're basically out of police range. You're where the sheriff only comes to when he absolutely has to. And yet, and we have a variety of everything from bootleggers to Baptists. They're all right there in one place. And nobody organizes it. We all know where it's going to be because it's the most logical place to have it. And so nobody really organizes it. But somehow food shows up, and the right food shows up. up and nobody kills each other. And we very often it turns into almost an auction of people buying and selling other things, you know, from each other that they brought just specifically because they knew a bunch of the family was going to be there. So, you know, we have armed people there. We have people who don't believe you should ever own a gun of any kind. There are people drinking beer. There are people who are aghast that someone might drink alcohol. And they're all right there getting along, functioning, and there's no authority telling them how to do that. And there's no, you know, there's no no aspect of it is a forced association. Anybody who is there by choice. So it's entirely voluntary. And yet, we don't kill each other, and everybody eats. And when there's always more food left over than you know than we can possibly even haul away.
Wow, that sounds like a lot of fun. Would they let strangers in like me?
Yeah, they would. And I think you know, out of everybody there, let's say if and the amount of people changes over the course of the day. Some people just come in for 15, 20 minutes. Some people will be there all day. Some people will be there a couple hours. So at any particular time, you might have 50 or 75 or 100 people there. And I think out of all of them, only, and you know, over the course of the day, that might be 200 or 300 people that have come through with a peak number of around 75 or 100. And out of all them, there might be 3 or 4 that have actually contemplated anarcho-capitalism or anarchy or voluntarism, or there might be only 1 or 2 or 3 or 4 that have ever even encountered these ideas. And yet all of them are living voluntarism from on a, you know, their life is an expression of it, and they don't even think about it. They don't realize it. I believe it was Frank Charteroff. I could be wrong on that because my memory's not so great. He once said that we don't teach libertarians. We teach to discover libertarians. And he made the argument that really and truly, it's deep down inside of people, and all you have to do is just touch the right things, and it'll either come out or it won't. And if it's not going to come out, it's not in there anyway. And I think a lot of people walk around with that inside of them, and they never really consider their actions, and they never really consider the philosophy end of it. But they're out there, I believe.
Well, now what about the coleslaw, though? I think this is your whole idea is foiled by the spoiled coleslaw and not having regulators that could come and, you know, make sure that it's kept at the right temperature all day. You know, there could be countless scores of people who get sick from the coleslaw. What do you do about that?
Well, when it starts to smell funny, we put it down on the floor and the dogs take care of it.
See that? He privatized it.
Wow.
Speaking of vegetables, isn't that weird?
are you going to talk about me?
No, not yet. You've posted on your forum that you've recently opened on your website what I thought was an amazing little contraption that could be used to kind of automatically water various kinds of plants over a period of time.
What kinds of plants?
It was potatoes in this example. And you've mentioned before that you spend a lot of time gardening. Do you garden just as a hobby, or do you garden for food, or both? And as an extension of that, do you think it's important that people who value libertarian type culture and morality should be spending more time in self-sufficiency efforts?
The last question first. Yeah, I really think we should. I think you know, anything can happen with the economy. Anything can happen with a storm, with a volcano, with a earthquake, or, you know, so having knowledge and preparedness is really good as a practical thing for everybody. For the libertarian minded person, who, especially if you have some knowledge of Austrian economics and so forth, then it's not hard to look at the current system and realize realize that there are, you know, at some point this thing's going to collapse, and at some point the governments are going to turn to violence. What we're seeing in Europe right now is a good example. And at some point, things are going to get nasty, and it may not be real convenient to run down to even to a farmer's market or something, may not even be available. So my intention in getting into gardening at first was, one was for the health benefits of just getting out in the yard and doing something, and the health benefit of having something on my mind other than everything else in the world that's crushing me. You know, you can really focus your mind on gardening when you're doing it, and it's a freedom from all the rest of the things that are happening around you. So it was therapeutic in that sense, but and healthy in the sense that now I'm eating foods that are not, you know, sprayed with a bunch of chemicals and grown with weird genetics or whatever. But in addition to all that, I learned as I drove myself to learn more and more about it, I started getting, like, I have plenty of room. I could easily grow enough food on my property for 15, 20 people to live off of, everything except the protein.
That comes from the zombies and the zombie apocalypse, right?
Exactly. But you have to boil it first.
Oh, yeah.
I drove myself to learn as compact gardening as possible in the situation where I wasn't living where I'm living now, and where I have to be very conservative with water, very conservative with soil, and very conservative with space. So that's what got me into using buckets and containers to see just how efficiently I could grow like that, how many years I could get a pepper plant to stay alive and produce, and you know, how to make a bucket system that doesn't require a lot of hoses and you know, tubing and things like this that would be self-watering, that I could, if I needed to put it someplace and leave it for a couple weeks and then come back, it would sit there and just take care of itself, and I wouldn't have to worry about it. And the other thing was insect control. And, you know, creating a good environment to create mulch, you know, so I can make my own good soil, because I didn't know, you know, what if I'm in a situation where I just don't have access to good soil, then how can I make good soil? So I drove myself to learn these things, because I think skills like that are often, they're so easy to learn if you put some effort into it, but they're also so easy to forget, even generationally, if we let ourselves. And then we become completely dependent on a system, grocery stores and highways and all state-regulated foods. That just didn't seem very libertarian to me, to be completely dependent upon other people to bring me stuff.
Now, you've mentioned your daughter, you know, on this show. You mentioned a grown son on one of your casts that I heard earlier today. How are they taking to, you know, your views on politics and or non-politics? And is it with them just, yeah, whatever, Dad? Or are they falling into it too? Are they growing into your shoes, I guess, is the question.
And it's two daughters, right?
Correct. Correct. Two daughters and one son. My two daughters, my oldest daughter, Kai, that's a sometime co-host with me, she was a hardline anarchist while I was still voting for Ron Paul, you know, years ago. In like 2008, I voted in the primaries for Ron Paul, and she was an anarchist then, mocking me for it, you know. My son, let me go to the other daughter. My younger daughter is also a recovering Ron Paul supporter. She actually supported him right up through the campaigns this year. And I think about the time that, well, long before the Republican convention, she saw the level of cheating and everything that was going on, mm-hmm. and it kind of popped her bubble when it came to believing that you could actually use the government to fix the government. And she's come full circle now. She is entirely on board with anarcho-capitalism and learning as quick as possible with, you know, things like from the Mises Institute and things like that. my son has always been less vocal about it, but he has if you can get him to talk about it, he's pretty solid in his position. But he just it doesn't really interest him. He likes playing music, and now he's starting a new family. He's got a baby coming in about a month, so he's kind of in a position where I was in that. You know, for years at a time, I just didn't want to think about it, because if you think about these things, you have to do something about them.
Yeah.
And if you do something about them, then you take risks, and you know, you're probably not going to be, well, at least you're going to be risking how you make a living, or, you know, how society looks on you and so forth. So it's really easy sometimes to just to just keep your head down and not say anything, and just, you know, go to work and come back and do your thing.
Or else you'll have the FBI monitoring your Gmail account, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Ben, you mentioned or used the term recovering Ron Paul supporter, I think. I'm gonna lean into you a little bit on that too, because Ron tells us that you were even more than a voter, right? Weren't you involved with his 88 campaign to some extent?
Not officially. You know, I was bouncing all over the internet, doing everything that I could there. I was putting out signs.
Were you the original internet troll?
Yeah, some people probably thought I was. But yeah, I was, you know, doing everything I could in 88. I, like so many other Ron Paul supporters, I didn't get paid or anything like that, but I was definitely putting as much time and effort into it. Wait a minute now. 2008, is what we were talking about. 2008, weren't we?
Oh no. I was talking about the 1998 one. I think you're on the right train of thought.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. In 88, I was actually active in I was a member of the Republican Party and a stand-in delegate to the Republican convention when I found out about Ron Paul. And I literally tore up my Republican card and joined the Libertarian Party to try to do everything that I could. And so I was blending two different stories there, years apart. Old people do that, in 88, I was pretty enthusiastic about him, and really pushed pretty hard, printed material on my own and distributed it, you know, everywhere that I could. And then we saw the results of all that, and it was pretty crushing to me, I think.
So you were probably like the Xerox troll back in 88 then, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You sneak into the office at the company where you work, you sneak into the office, you make 500 copies, come back a little bit later, make another 500 copies. Where's all the paper going to? I don't know.
It's the janitor, I say.
That was a campaign that I think Rothbard officially endorsed, if YouTube videos have taught me anything.
Yeah, I think he did, and Lou Rockwell, I believe, was like, I don't think he was a campaign manager, but he was up there like that in the campaign.
Hmm. So we like to do something with our guests whenever we're about to wrap up a show. I don't know if you're already aware of this clever trap we've set for you or not yet, Ben, but we like to do something called Bizarro Mode, where we put a guest on the spot, and we ask him to come up with a very strong argument against a position that he holds dear to himself. You think you can do this mental twister for us?
Playing devil's advocate, if you will, or if you want to indulge us.
But Michael called it putting on his minarchist hat.
Oh, yeah, if I remember right. He just went briefly into the past, and it was, of course, very convincing because it was just him.
You know, I knew you guys did that, and I even thought about it for a moment, and then I forgot that I was thinking about it and failed to prepare anything for it. So I'm not sure. I suppose I could mimic my brother. How would that be?
Ooh, that's good.
Okay. Yeah, whatever it tells you.
Well, of course we need leadership. We have to have leadership. And you can't have leadership without government, because otherwise people will just fall in every direction and nobody will know who to obey. So you have to have firm leadership. And within a structure of any kind, you have to have a hierarchy. Everybody has to know exactly who's ahead of them. If every dog doesn't look ahead and see the butt of the dog in front of him, then he's not going to know where to go. And the only way that the sled can get moved from point A to point B is if every dog keeps his nose as close to the butt in front of him as he can and pulls with everything he's got. And that means there can only be one dog in front of this sled, and that one dog has to lead and everybody else has to follow. And if you have any other way other than that, you're not going to get anywhere. How's that?
Your brother should have his own show. That's great.
No, don't tell him that.
Whose butt is in front of the lead dog?
The zombies are all going, asshole, asshole.
That's, you're actually speaking the Vermin Supreme platform right now. you get a big turbine and then some rods out, and you strap zombies to it, and you get them. You just dangle brains, I think, instead of carrots, and have them go around in circles, and it's pretty much limitless energy, which, you know, I don't think any other candidate brought that to the table this time around.
Did he really talk about that? I don't remember that.
Oh, yeah, you got to watch that thing to the end. Did you see the part where he turned the guy gay?
I do remember the glitter bomb.
Okay.
That was the part that stuck with me.
I saw that. That was great.
That was political magic.
So how many votes did he get? How many votes did he get? Is there a tally yet?
I don't know. We should recount, because maybe he actually beat Obama this time.
God, that'd
there be could have been enough hanging chads in Florida or something. You never know.
Oh, that reminds me of something. I bet Ben can make a quick comment on it before we run out of time. You've brought this up on a podcast pretty recently, Ben, that there is good news for persons who value morality like we do, and that is that the majority of the population, it seems that way anyhow, and this amount is increasing, actually have not given their consent to the current system by voting for Barack Romney or Mitt Obama.
Yeah, there's a couple of good ways to look at that. First off, of registered voters, people who, you know, believe in voting and they have voted before, and they, you know, of registered voters, only about half of them bothered to go out and have a, you know, as they say, have a voice. But registered voters are a minority of the population. Most people don't even bother to register because they know the system is corrupt or useless. So deep down inside, if you're going to do something, it doesn't matter what you're going to do. You're going to tie your shoe. You're going to, you know, whatever. You have to believe that there's some purpose behind doing it. And so half the people in America don't believe there's a good enough purpose in registering to vote. And half the people who registered to vote didn't believe there was a good enough reason to walk down there and actually do it. So that means a huge portion of Americans don't trust or don't care about what those people in Washington are doing.
And I guess there's even additional people in the U.S. who aren't even able to register to vote because they're convicts or they're foreign nationals and stuff like that.
Yeah, imagine, you're in some states, you're captured with the leaves of some plants, and you end up spending years in prison over that, and then you come out and you're told, now you can't even vote about the issue when it comes up on a ballot. That, you know, somewhere deep inside a person's mind, that has to just be like nails on a chalkboard, you know?
Yeah, you think the people that would particularly want to weigh in, I wonder why.
Yeah, and if it's a felony charge, you can't leave the country either, so you're stuck. You're screwed.
Permanent imprisonment, in a matter of fact, really, as a matter of practicality.
Yeah.
But, you know, there is that bit of good news. So, you know, whenever you guys out there are feeling a little bit down and you feel you're surrounded by sheep, just remember that it may be some people reach the same conclusion you reach now without even having to do quite as much reading as you did.
Vermin Supreme 2016. It's about 11 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, which is Ohio time, I believe. And 8 p.m. Pacific, and the sun has long since set over the West Coast now that winter is coming. We welcome any bad Quaker listeners and readers to check out the Declined Estate archives as we continue to spread the message on Decline FM or Declined Estate on iTunes. I would like to remind you that Declined Estate is still brought to you free of charge, as well as commercial free, and a big thanks to all of our hosts, tech experts, researchers, contributors, our listeners, and Ben Stone, the badass Quaker, for joining us. Declined Estate is a group effort motivated by our love of liberty, as well as capitalist bow ties and free market monocles. Remember, when asked, always decline to state. This is Ron McPaul saying goodnight to all the voluntarists out there, even the ones who are voluntarists without even knowing it.
This is Kwashiorkor thinking about growing my beard out now.
Wrong Opinion signing off from the Rust Belt. Thank you so much for joining us, Ben. It's been a real pleasure.
And thank you.